Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
I think my passion for human rights has been driven by people that have been in my circle of family and friends and community. And putting my hand up for this job, I thought, was the next sort of logical step in my career development. But also because I'm passionate about human rights and because I see injustice in every space that we navigate in our daily lives. And I feel like I have the skills and the knowledge because of who I've been taught by to be able to take some of these agendas forward.
Katie Kiss, appointed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. Katie Kiss is a Kanju and Biriwiti woman who grew up in Rockhampton in central Queensland. She's just the fifth person and second woman to be appointed to the position of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. Mick Dodson was the first to take on the role back in 1993 in the aftermath of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Katie was previously Executive Director of the Interim Truth and Treaty Body supporting Queensland's path to treaty. She's also held a number of prominent government positions, including as Senior Advisor to the Deputy Premier. Katie says she hopes to use her time as Commissioner to bring awareness to issues of structural and systemic discrimination. Before we hear our interview, I thought we could revisit a recent conversation I had with June Oscar. June stood down from the role earlier this year, a position she took on back in 2017. June has spent most of her life working in remote communities and has always been passionate about addressing challenges facing Aboriginal women and children.
In that process of shaping the adult that we become, and my mother shared with me that children are born to be wise and responsible elders, but we must ensure that we apply this process of ensuring that these young people become the responsible people that we need them to be. So, you know, the ceremonies around what is, you know, sometimes referred to as smoking ceremony, but it was a ceremony of, you know, blessing and speaking to the child at different stages of development throughout our childhood development into adults. Where now I practice that with, you know, my mob, ensuring that young children are smoked and are taught and are told the rules around being respectful, being helpful, being strong and confident. So there are many other things in how we lived our lives that fed into shaping our knowledge and giving us confidence. And that's certainly where I receive my groundedness and confidence. And my grandmother, she didn't trust white fellas, but she just tolerated them. But she was, you know, she was strong. She just knew every plant, animal, water, place, rock formation, hills, rivers, creeks and springs on Boonooba country. And, you know, I just had a wonderful opportunity of being raised by her.
It's, I think, really important to remember how much of that work you did and how visible it was to the rest of us around the country watching what you were doing there, because when you came to be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, it was heralded, of course, and embraced because you were the first woman appointed to the role. But actually, I think from a community perspective, it was much more than that. It was because you had done this kind of real hard yards back in the community. What made you want to come and do that role, to move from your country and take on a national role? Was it an easy decision or a hard one?
Oh, look, it was the right time, I thought, right time in my life to throw my hat in the ring, as they say. So I thought when I had seen the job advertised and was made aware of this vacancy, I thought as a Aboriginal woman, I've seen some great men in this role and I absolutely respect them, but I think it's time for Aboriginal women to occupy this role at a national level. And this is such an important role as it focuses around defending human rights and anti-discrimination as it's experienced by Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, but as the Australian Human Rights Commission being Australia's leading human rights institution. I, you know, really aspired and was drawn to have a go at what this role could be. And, you know, fortunately, there is the flexibility and the freedom of the person in the role identifying key projects and spaces to elevate Indigenous people's voices around our rights and our right to agency. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be fantastic, having spent 12 years at Maninwandigura, the Women's Resource Centre in Fitzroy Crossing, working with incredible Aboriginal women, local, those who came from outside, and the non-Indigenous women who came with their skills, their gifts, their talents to work in that community. I thought, wouldn't it be good to try and bring a focus to women's issues at this national level within human rights and self-determination and the right to agency, and to elevate voices of women who often don't get heard?
I think if one looks back at your time as Social Justice Commissioner, you've stayed very true to that. You've had some major projects that have focused, amongst the many other work pieces of work that you've done more holistically, but there's certainly been a strong strand of listening to women's voices and finding a space for them. And of course, one of the key pieces of work was the report that came out in 2020, Wihi Yani Uthangani Women's Voices. Can you tell us a little bit about the process you went through with that and what it's achieved to date?
Yeah, sure. Once we secured, government support in terms of funding to assemble a team of people, I was very clear that my national project would be around engagement with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and girls across the country, across all of our diversity in, you know, urban settings, in regional towns, in remote communities and very remote communities, as well as women and young women who were in women's prisons and young women's detention centres. So we focused on what it was that were the priorities of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, but starting from a very empowering and strength-focused way, in asking women, what is it that can, enables you to achieve all that you achieve in terms of your roles, your interests, and, you know, what and who are the critical factors that are your enablers? And then we asked them, what was it that, causes fear, frustration, anxiety, and your drive to want to change something came thirdly. If you could change something, what could it be? And what should that look like? Who should be involved? What's your role in it? So that they were the questions that we put to the women and girls right across the country. It didn't change. It was the same questions. But I made sure that women and girls, for wherever we went, weren't being asked to be included in a national engagement process or consultation where I set the agenda for what I wanted to hear. I flipped that around to be clear to women and girls is that you talk to me about what you want me to know about you, and if you're happy to share that, you can we'll put that in a report because I'm required to table a report in federal parliament. So women and girls felt, and many commented to me, that they had never been asked to just come to a gathering, to a session, as who they are, as black women. It was either around a topic or someone else needed to know something from them. And I said to them, this is what I want you to feel and see in terms of what it looks like to take a human rights-based approach to engagements. And women have said, and girls, we've never had this experience before. It's always somebody wanting something from us and saying, we can only talk about this. No one's ever asked me what makes me deadly, what makes me want to strive to make things better, and who are the people that are important to me in my life, and what is it that that frustrates me and makes me stay focused and want to change things. No one's ever asked me that. And so these gatherings, as you can imagine, Larissa, were quite emotional. So women really opened up and talked from their heart, from right in the pit of their stomachs, around issues that were important to them. And then we met with over 2,000 women and girls, First Nations women and girls. We were able to then go through the hard work of drafting and sending back to them their narratives, seeing if they were happy with that. And, with my incredible team, we were able to present the report to Federal Parliament on the 9th of December 2020, written and spoken in the voices of every single one of those women and girls. It is the first time in Australia that this has happened. After 36 years from when Charles Perkins, rest in peace, headed DAA and commissioned the Women's Business Report in 1986. So this was, this was a long time coming. It was something that I remembered as a young woman, seeing DAA staff visit our camps in around Fitzroy Crossing and talk to women about, things that were important to women in our communities. And I remember reading the Women's Business Report when I became an ATSIC commissioner when I was about 28 years old. I remember, holding that document for years in my home. And I just thought, we have to honour our first matriarchs of this country. We have to deliver justice for them. But we have to do it on their terms, on their issues, informed by them through their voices. And so we Yaniyu Dangani, which is in my language Bunuba, we meaning women, we Yani meaning big mobs of women, U meaning four big mobs of women, and Dangani meaning voice or word or language. So that's the name of the report, we Yaniyu Dangani, and the project. securing our rights, securing our futures. So, you know, I was proud to present the nation with, a report that's elevated all of those voices on the issues that matter for them, and to assist those in spaces of influence to use that report when they're considering programs and decisions, policies, legislation that impact the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and girls in our country. You know, there is no excuse. That's a landmark report, and it belongs to our First Nations women and girls. But leading on from there, we've done a lot of work in elevating the voices through the We Yani Udangani project. We have created some fantastic interactive tools to continue to share the message, bring focus to these issues that women and girls have raised with us. And now, as I'm nearing the end of my term, I'm finalising the priorities of stage three in the development of a change agenda that will provide a blueprint for delivering lasting change across relevant policies and programs of government, industry and service providers. So, you know, we've been doing some really important work in the development of that, and that will drive the work of the We Yani Udangani Gender Justice Institute that we're establishing at the ANU and will be launching in March this year.
What would you say to young First Nations women who are listening? There is a role for them, but increasingly with the hostility of social media, the trolling, the racism, it's not always easy for young women to feel like they have got the strength. If they're listening to you now and you've identified this really important role for them, what's your advice to them?
Look, I constantly hear from lots of young women, whilst that is the reality that many of them are impacted by the trolling, the social media, the, you know, little Snapchats and the little grabs, that really can diminish someone's spirit and really turn their worlds into turmoil. Just remind yourself what you're made of, who you are, where you've come from, what's important to you and your family. Don't lose sight of the fact that you come from the oldest civilization on this planet. You're not here by accident. You're here for a purpose. And you may not fully be aware and understand and appreciate all of that right now if you're a young person, but it will come to you. You will see it and you will know what it is that you must be doing in this world whilst we're here and whilst we all need to contribute, and we all have a place to make a contribution for a better society that we can all be proud of and enjoy and be safe in.
That's former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner June Oscar. She was speaking to me earlier this year following her decision to stand down from the role. Katie Kiss has since been appointed to the position, and you'll hear from her shortly.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia, on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Coming up, my conversation with newly appointed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, Katie Kiss. Katie comes to the role after decades of experience working with Aboriginal communities throughout Queensland. Right now, though, some music from Arranta country singer Warren H. Williams.
Master Red to Burgundy and his benefaction to gold. Just come out of the mold, girl, where the plans forever roll. And Albert Namajira has painted all the scenes, and a shower has changed the luster of our land. And it's raining on the run in a beautiful country. And I'm proud to travel this big land as an Aborigine. It's raining on the run. What an almighty sight to see. And I'm wishing and I'm dreaming that you were here with me.
Everlasting daisies and a beautiful desert rose. Where does their beauty come from? Heaven knows.
I could ask the witch tale, but he's way too high. I wonder if he understands. It's wonderful to fly. And it's raining on the run in a beautiful country. I'm proud to travel this big land as an Aborigine. It's raining on the run. What an almighty sight to see. And I'm wishing and I'm dreaming that you were here with me.
Described with a picture, the mesmerizing colors of the ogres,
or the grandeur of the rock. Uluru is power. It's raining on the rock in a beautiful country. Proud to travel this big land as an Aborigine. It's raining on the rock. What an almighty sight to see. And I'm wishing and I'm dreaming that you were here with me.
That's Warren H. Williams alongside John Williamson with Raining on the Rock.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
Katie Kiss comes to the role of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner after decades of experience working with Aboriginal communities throughout Queensland. She's also held a number of prominent government positions, including as Senior Advisor to the Deputy Premier of Queensland. I began our interview by asking her to reflect on how her upbringing helped shape her outlook on life.
I was born and bred on the lands of the Darrumbal people in Rockhampton. I am a Kanju Widi Biri woman. My grandmother's country is up around Cowan in Cape York, and my grandfather's country is within the Bowen Basin, from around Collinsville through to Nebo. They were part of the, I suppose you could call them stolen generations, but not really. So they were moved, both of them, to Palm Island with their families and met and married over there and had their first five children. My mother was the last of the first five born on Palm Island. And then when she was about 5 years old, they moved down to Warrabinda during the First World War, the Second World War, when they moved the people from Hopevale and Cape Bedford down to Warrabinda during the war. My grandfather was one of a couple of carpenters that were moved from other missions to Warrabinda to build houses for those people coming through. And then they received exemption under the Act and moved into Rockhampton. So I was born and bred on the lands of the Darrumbal and lived most of my life there. I was lucky enough to get a job up in Cairns, so I reconnected with my family up there and then got a job with the Human Rights Commission. So it's not my first rodeo in the Human Rights Commission. I've been there twice now, and I was part of the Social Justice Unit through both Commissioner Kalmar and Commissioner Gooder's terms, and now I'm back as the Social Justice Commissioner, and I'm very excited about that. I suppose just personally, I'm a mum. I've got three children and eight grandchildren, and my sense of social justice comes from a grandfather who fought to have our rights recognised, and now as a mother who is very determined to make sure that the rights of my children, my grandchildren and our community's children are adhered to and respected.
You do bring so much experience with you from the human rights sector into the role, and I want to break down that a little bit further on. But just before we move on from there, you know, obviously you came and you mentioned you worked with two of the other social justice commissioners, but there's been an enormous change in terms of how we understand human rights and the mechanisms through which they're protected from your grandparents' and parents' era through to this era that you're working in now. Were there particular thinkers or rights advocates of the past that have particularly inspired you? I'm thinking more about where you might get some of your intellectual inspiration from.
Obviously, my grandfather was very active in the human rights space in Rockhampton. Having, you know, come from the background that he did, he wasn't affluent in literacy or numeracy, and he used to get my auntie to write a lot of letters to the editor to the Morning Bulletin in Rockhampton. So he was considered a man before his time, very smart man, and even though he couldn't read and write all that well, he was affluent in the rights agenda. And then I suppose as I got older, people like Nelson Mandela became very inspirational to me. And then looking at our own Aboriginal leadership, you know, Mick Dodson, one of the first social justice commissioners, was also the special rapporteur on the rights of Indigenous people. So having people like him mentor me, one of my first jobs was up at Cape York Land Council. Noel Pearson was one of the leadership up there at that point in time and continues to be. So I've had some pretty special, inspirational people in my life who have mentored me, taught me along the way, and I suppose supported and nurtured me in developing my capacity to be sitting in the role that I'm in today.
I just did want to ask you about that. You'd obviously, as you said, you've worked in the commission, not your first rodeo. What was it that made you want to put your hand up for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner role? What attracted you to it?
I've always been passionate about human rights, Larissa. It's been something that has driven me from a very young age, sitting on the front steps at 252 Grub Street in Rockhampton, my grandparents' home. They were one of the first Aboriginal families to own a home in Rockhampton. And just, I think, having that constant exposure to conversations from the leadership of that time, like Mick Gooder's mother, Nana Shirley Gooder, was one of the leaders in Rockhampton, along with my grandfather, who set up the Aboriginal Legal Services and the Aboriginal Health Services in that community. They fought for education. My grandfather always said to me, you know, you need to arm yourself with their knowledge so that you can engage in their society and don't ever forget where you come from. So I think my passion for human rights has been driven by people that have been in my circle of family and friends and community, and putting my hand up for this job, I thought was the next sort of logical step in my career development, but also because I'm passionate about human rights and because I see injustice in every space that we navigate in our daily lives. And I feel like I have the skills and the knowledge because of who I've been taught by to be able to take some of these agendas forward.
Knowing you, I know you would not have thought about it lightly. In fact, I'm sure you thought about it very deeply. When you put your hand up for the role, what were some of the things you thought you might like to achieve if you took it on?
There's so much to deal with, Larissa. You know, we all sat through a very challenging voice referendum at the end of last year. Something that I expected to be a positive experience for all Australians turned into something that wasn't as positive. The outcome of the referendum has deeply hurt First Nations people, but I think it's also done a fair bit of damage to the relationship between Australians and First Nations people. I think we've got a bit of work to do to get that relationship back on track, and that's something that I would like to see happen during my term. So dealing with the full three pillars of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, being voice, treaty and truth, is something that I would like to work with our communities, but also with government, to work out the alternative arrangements around that. You know, so 7 months on, it's what's now? What next? What do we have to do to get that relationship back on track? The Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is 16 years down the track now from when Australia changed its position to support and endorse the Declaration. The Declaration includes a whole lot of human rights in there that are already recognised under Australia's international legal obligations. And it's about time, I think, that we started to talk about a national plan for implementing that Declaration and ensuring that the legal obligations that Australia already has are applied as they need to be in the context of addressing the rights of First Nations people. So no new rights, but applying rights that we already have to ensure that they meet the needs of our individual circumstances as First Nations people. Youth justice obviously is at national crisis point across the country. We need to have a reframed discussion about access to justice and making sure that we are able to balance the needs and the rights of both victims, but also of our children who are exposed to the system. I attended a forum in Canberra last week with public servants, and there was a discussion had there about an assumption that the system is actually working. I mean, we're sitting in a period of time where we're seeing national crises in cost of living, a national crisis in housing, national crisis in domestic and family violence, a national crisis in youth justice with children being removed from their families and put in out-of-home care, the over-extenuating incarceration rates and high levels of suicide and death in our families and our communities. I would argue the system is in free fall. So under the auspice of the National Closing the Gap Agreement and a conversation about access to justice that isn't justice from a negative perspective but from a positive perspective, I think we need to do a lot of work in turning the system back into something that creates the conditions for positive outcomes rather than the negative outcomes that we're seeing across the sphere.
As you say, there's so much work to be done, and it's an ambitious agenda, but one that's responding to the needs of the community. Because you have had so much experience working within the Commission, I wonder if you could share with us what you think might be some of the challenges that the Commission as an institution is facing that might actually make it more of a challenge to achieve some of the things that you might like to achieve during your tenure.
Well, Larissa, I think the language of human rights is something that most Australians are not necessarily familiar with. I think the Commission has a key role in raising awareness and education on human rights, how they are experienced by the broader population, but also incorporating that into the everyday vernacular of Australians. Like, I keep having these conversations where people say to me, we need to make human rights accessible for all Australians. But my view is we need to actually teach Australians about what human rights are. And some of the challenges that I see happening come into that conversation around voice, treaty and truth, where, you know, the education system doesn't provide those basic civil education outcomes where people are exposed to the truth of what's happened in this country, but they're also not educated in what their actual human rights are and how they can advocate for those. So in building the capacity for Australians generally to engage in a dialogue about human rights, we need to do some really strong work around building capacity, awareness raising and education in that space. I think the other key challenge for my office, the Office of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, is the need to deal with racism and all of the things that I've already spoken to today, all of these national crises that we are talking about, experienced by First Nations people in different ways to how they're experienced by the broader population. And part of that is the result of systemic and structural discrimination and racism in the system. And the Human Rights Commission also has a key role to play in working with government to reduce and mitigate the impacts of that experience of racism, structural and systemic, that First Nations experience every day in every aspect of their lives.
We've spoken about the fact that you have such great experience within the Human Rights Commission itself, but I just want to pick up on other experiences that you're bringing to the role, which I think are really important. You, prior to taking on this role of Social Justice Commissioner, you were working on the treaty process in Queensland, most recently in the role of Executive Director of the Interim Truth and Treaty Body. What have you learnt from those processes on the ground?
The truth and treaty process in Queensland has been an amazing experience for me. We did a lot of consultation with First Nations Queenslanders across the state, but also mainstream. We had a lot of non-Indigenous Queenslanders participate in our consultation and engagement, but also on the back of the referendum, we really saw the uplift of Queenslanders who wanted to support the First Nations process of truth and treaty. And, you know, I think having the consultation process back in the fact that Queenslanders do want to see a truth-telling process. They are ready for a reframed relationship. They want to have this debate and this dialogue and sit with each other and talk about our differences, but how do we make those join together and have a positive, more positive future together? I think that's some of the key learnings that have come out of the work that we've done at the Interim Truth and Treaty Body and the processes before that as well. We had a eminent panel and a treaty working group in stage one. We had the Treaty Advancement Committee in stage two. And then in this last stage, we've had the Interim Truth and Treaty Body. And in the last week, we've seen the appointment now of our formal Truth-Telling and Healing Inquiry members, as well as the appointment of the members to the Treaty Institute, which will kick off almost straight away. So the work with Queensland Government around making this process happen and successful, I think has been a lesson for other states and territories who are starting to explore opportunities to put truth and treaty in place in their jurisdictions. And I think we've got a fair way to go yet, Larissa. Like, this is a learning journey for everybody in the country. I think that's the other thing that we need to pick up from this, is that this has not been done before. So Victoria is a little bit more advanced than Queensland, but we're all learning as we go. So let's be kind to each other as we take this journey together, understanding that these conversations have not been had in a coordinated and constructive way before, and we need to care for each other in the conversation that we're about to have as a nation.
I was going to ask you about that, having been on the ground and witnessing the process in action, learning, I guess, as you said, that, you know, what works and what doesn't. What do you think is the flow on for these conversations nationally from these state-based treaty processes? And I'm thinking particularly of your ambition to look at the pillars of the Uluru Statement at a national level. What lessons can be learnt from what we've seen happening at the states?
Yeah, Larissa, I think there's a couple of things that we need to take from both the voice process and the truth and treaty processes that are starting to roll out. One in particular is that the experience of colonisation for every jurisdiction is different. So the Victorian process obviously has created a structural arrangement that deals with the First Nations governance arrangements for people in Victoria, but also their experience of colonisation. In Queensland, we had extensive removals from First Nations communities, families, country, culture. People were removed to reserves and missions and dislocated from their cultural arrangements, dispossessed from country, and disengaged in the ability for them to be able to celebrate their identity as First Nations people. And so I think the Queensland experience will be very different looking to what the Victorian experience is. The Northern Territory experience needs to be different again. Their experience of colonisation was later, different. And so what we need to do at a national level is set some guiding principles, overarching arrangements, rules of engagement about how do we then, the principles that underpin these conversations as they go forward, without undermining the different approaches that need to be undertaken in each jurisdiction to pay respect to and acknowledge the different experiences of First Nations people in the colonisation process across the country.
It's an ambitious national agenda. And I'm wondering, thinking back on your reflections you made about the impact of the referendum process, how you think the state of play sits nationally. What were your observations about the impact the referendum might have on the appetite from politicians and the public for the sorts of changes or opportunities that you're talking about?
I was actually probably one of the most optimistic people in Australia when the Prime Minister announced that he was going to progress the referendum. I thought we had matured enough as a country to progress this to a successful outcome. Obviously, I was bitterly disappointed on the night of the referendum when it was called that we had been defeated and that Australia had voted to not recognise a voice for First Nations people. I think coming through the national or the global pandemic of COVID, in Australia we saw the nation unite in a way that I have never seen before in my lifetime, where communities came together to support each other, where the care community came together to make sure that our next door neighbours had food, that our senior people in the community were looked after, and we saw governments step up, unite, and make sure that those in our First Nations remote communities were not going to be devastated by this global pandemic, which was a very real risk. I think the global pandemic taught us that when governments and communities work together with care as a foundational value of what we're doing, we can achieve great things. And I think the same needs to be said for this national conversation that we need to have around voice, treaty and truth in order for us to heal as a nation. I am very concerned on the back of the voice referendum outcome that this conversation that is absolutely critical to us as a nation to heal will be used as a political football for political point scoring. And we're seeing that directly days after the referendum, where in Queensland we saw the opposition make public announcements about an intention to repeal the treaty legislation that they supported 100%. So these are the kind of conversations that we need to be dealing with. We need to be working with both sides of politics, current government as well as opposition parties, to ensure that the rights of First Nations people don't become political footballs in the game of politics. Our lives are much more important than that. And, yeah, we need to just focus on the outcome, not whether we can win the election or not.
You mentioned the issue of youth violence as one of the national conversations that keep coming up and you want to reset. The other national conversation that we've been having at the moment is about violence against women. And First Nations women are, as you know, overrepresented as victims of domestic and intimate partner violence. Do you have any thoughts on how to better address this issue that's also a national crisis?
I do, Larissa, and I think we have to reset how the system responds to these kinds of issues. So children are being punished for intergenerational poverty and disadvantage. Families are being punished for intergenerational poverty and disadvantage. There needs to be a reset in how the system responds. We are constantly responding at the tertiary end once we're at crisis point, rather than investing in prevention and early intervention programs and strategies that support communities, families and young people to have positive outcomes in their lives. It's too late once a child has been arrested for stealing a car. It's too late once a partner has abused his intimate partner and is being arrested for domestic and family violence. We need to get to the front end of the system, the universal end of the system, where everybody should have access to supports that help them become functioning and positively thriving families and communities, so that our children aren't exposed to the out-of-home care system that then creates the pipeline for youth justice and creates the pipeline into the adult prison system. You know, I just think we're looking at this from the wrong end of the stick at the moment, and we've got to get refocused on this stuff in order to make some positive difference.
I think one of the important things that comes out of what you just mentioned there, so I want to highlight it, is the way that you understand how all these crises are interrelated, that actually the issue of out-of-home care numbers is actually related to the levels of domestic violence, that these are actually related to the closing the gap issues. It does seem to say that a holistic account is needed across all of these areas.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we've got report after report after report. We've got 30 years of Social Justice Commissioner's reports. We've got the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody. We've got the Bringing Them Home report. We've got countless Productivity Commission reports and Auditor General reports that say the same thing about recommendations needing a holistic response across government to deal with the social indicators and the social determinants of health that continue to contribute to disadvantaged outcomes for First Nations people. And can I say, it's not just First Nations people, it's Australians generally. As I said before, we're dealing with national crises across a number of platforms. So it's not just our people that are suffering or struggling in the current government support landscape. It's Australians more broadly. And so until we have a bit more of a coordinated, collaborated and holistic response to some of these issues, we are not going to see changes in these areas. You know, the government response to dealing with youth justice is to go and build more detention centres so that we can lock more of our kids up. That supports an industry of contractors who have to meet bed quotas in order to get their contract paid. That system is not working to support a diversion of people out of the system. It's continuing to entrench people being brought into the system. We can't continue to operate like that.
The challenges are enormous, and I think we've used the word crisis appropriately. But when you look back over the period of time that you've been working on First Nations rights, what do you consider to be the greatest areas where we've progressed? What have been the achievements?
I think the closing the gap framework and policy approach has been a significant achievement. Even though we're, you know, still struggling to get some runs on the board with the majority of the targets and all that sort of stuff, we are raising the profile of the need to do better across the board in terms of First Nations people having access to things that make their lives better. So I think the closing the gap policy arrangement, which started with the Social Justice Commissioner back in Tom Kelmer's term, actually, I think that's a positive policy arrangement, but we've got more work to do in that space, obviously. We're still so far behind the eight ball on that, but it is a positive outcome. The second positive outcome I probably would want to highlight is the Australian endorsement of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. My view is that the declaration provides an absolute blueprint for First Nations people to understand what their rights are and what they need to do to advocate for those rights around self-determination, participation in decisions that affect you, protection and respect for your culture, and ensuring that you don't experience discrimination. I think the declaration provides us with the blueprint for that, but it also provides an absolute blueprint for government to understand what their responsibilities are and how they respond to achieving human rights for the First Nations population in this country in a way that respects our cultural needs and cultural safety in the process.
On a personal level, how will you measure your achievements or success in the Social Justice Commissioner position?
Well, Larissa, it's a little bit hard to determine that at this point. As you said, my agenda is very ambitious and we're looking at a lot of national reform, high-level reform, things that will set the foundation for a different approach to how policy is implemented in a First Nations perspective. I haven't turned my mind to measuring outcomes yet. I'm about to launch, hopefully, a national listening tour on the back of the referendum. I think it's time that we need to have a bit of a reset on what are some of the key issues that our people think are affecting them. But I also want to get their perspective around what are the things that they see as changed for the positive and continue to build on those. So I will be looking at how do I measure the outcome of my term, but I haven't got to that point yet.
What advice do you have for young First Nations people, particularly women, who might be thinking about being public advocates for their communities, but knowing, as you mentioned, the backlash around the referendum made a pretty hostile public space. Of course, all the elements on social media also make it very difficult for people to contribute to public life. But what is your advice for people who are thinking about making a contribution?
One of the key things I want to talk about during my term, Larissa, is the re-establishment of the concept of the village. I talked earlier about the care community that we saw emerge as a result of the global pandemic and the COVID experience. And I think one of the things that has been damaged as a result of our experience of colonisation, and probably more so in the last 20 to 30 years, has been the concept of the village. And I talked about the mentors that I've had in my life earlier, and not just the academic and high-level human rights mentors that I've had in my life, but also the everyday supports that I've had to get me to the position that I'm in. I pay respect to my children's grandmothers who looked after my children while I had to go to work to support them and enabled me to go and study to finish my degree. So I wouldn't be sitting here today if I didn't have a village around me that supported me to do the work that I have to do. So in terms of advice to young people and young women in particular, my advice to you is make sure that you draw on your village. Make sure that you identify who those people are in your village to support you to achieve the outcomes that you want to. We need our advocates being supported. We need them being able to step up. Take whatever relationship you can build with some of your senior leaders in your community and be a sponge. Be a sponge to everything they want to give you, I think, is the advice that I would give.
It's good advice, not just for young people, but for old people as well, like
Absolutely.
Myself.
Yeah.
Got to love a village. Just finally, obviously, working in human rights is pretty hard slog. There's a lot to process, a lot to put up with. When you're away from work, how do you relax? How do you take the pressures off?
I have a Rottweiler at home. His name is Zeus. He is... just looking at him brings my blood pressure down. But I also enjoy dancing music. I love reggae music, but I also love salsa dancing. So I don't get to listen to music during the week. I spend a lot of my time reading and trying to get across the issues that we're trying to deal with. So on weekends, I do like to have some downtime listening to music, patting my Rottweiler and trying to have the opportunity to see my grandchildren as much as possible. I have three that live in Cairns, three in Gladstone and two here in Brisbane. And so I only ever really get to see these two here in Brisbane often. And I got to spend some time with my youngest, who is 8 weeks old yesterday for Mother's Day, because I won't be here next week. So, I do try to spend as much time with my family as possible, but it's hard when you're in roles like what we are in.
That's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner Katie Kiss. As you've heard, Katie brings loads of experience and energy to the role, and I know she will achieve great things. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister, and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.